Good afternoon and welcome to Education Matters, WHRV's ongoing discussion with area educators about the issues facing today's classroom teachers. I'm Barry Graham. Today, our in-studio guest is Dr. Anthony Vladu, superintendent of the Gloucester County Public Schools. Dr. Vladu assumed head of the division in 2023 after serving in the military and after beginning a career in education as a classroom teacher, school principal, and division administrator. How are the Gloucester schools doing now, 5 years after the pandemic shutdown? What initiatives are being implemented to ensure student success? And what did his most recently submitted budget detail? We're taking your calls with Dr. Anthony Vladu. It's Education Matters, next after this news break from NPR and the WHRO Newsroom. Good afternoon and welcome to Education Matters. I'm Barry Graham. Our in-studio guest today is Dr. Anthony Vladu, superintendent of the Gloucester County Public Schools. And a note of transparency, Gloucester County Public Schools are stakeholders in Heretta, which holds the license for the WHRO stations. We are taking your calls today live here in the studio, 757-440-2665. Dr. Vladu, welcome, and thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you, Barry. And before I get started, I want to thank you and the WHRV HRO family for having me. I think providing more insight into a complex issue of education today, it's really a helpful thing for our community.
Well, again, thank you. This is an important community discussion that needs to be made. Now, first, before we get into some of the looking at the division, your background in education, which when I was preparing for your appearance here, it really inspired me. You immigrated to the United States at a young age from Romania. You served in the U.S. military, and then you began your career in education as a classroom teacher before you advanced into administration, beginning as a building administrator, then also as a front office positions. First, thank you very much for your service, not only to children, but to the country as a veteran. I'm sure there have been comments made to you about combat training you received being very adequate for your role in public education.
I say the best training I received is how to be a good teacher, because even in my position, you know, teaching folks about the things that we do. But my service in the military helped me be here today through the GI Bill and also the leadership aspects of that as well. But my life work, I really wanted to be remembered for being an educator.
Did you plan that career? Did you have an early desire to become an educator?
No, I did not. But I did do something that I recognized when I got out of the military. I wanted to live a life of service. And so I joined straight out of high school, trying to find meaning in life. Didn't speak English, or not much anyway. Struggled to school and ended up in the United States Army. So in there, I developed my first family. People they get really close with, they support you. And in the military, is I found, you know, I connected to folks and I love serving my country and I love doing something bigger than myself. So what does a man do when they get out of the military and want to continue to serve? You know, they look at other professions, but I landed in education because I want to give back and I want to make a difference in the lives of people, students in my community.
You mentioned struggling in school somewhat. How much did that impact your desire to actually go into education and hopefully make a difference?
So as I look back at my time in public school, so I came here, I was missing 3 or 4 years of education. In communist Romania, my parents were persecuted because they wanted to leave. And in that context, they stripped us of our citizenship and basically were kicked out of school. So when we came to the United States, I was 12 and a half, but my last grade completed was fourth grade. So I was placed in the seventh grade classroom and I didn't speak any English in Mr. O'Reilly's class. And then I had a number of educators who really inspired me, like Mr. Wolf, Narrowsburg, New York, who was a former Marine, and Ms. Jaggi, social studies teacher. And these folks had a profound impact on my life because I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for them. At that time, I didn't think it was a big deal. But as I look back at my life, the reason I'm here today is because of caring educators.
There really were some inspiration there for you with these teachers.
Absolutely, because they do an incredibly difficult and complex job. They build relationships and they actually try to engage every student. So that's noble work. And that's really what makes this job so special.
What advantages does it provide for someone who's been at practically every level of the educational system? You find yourself heading a division, starting, you know, as a classroom teacher, something before we went on the air, you and I were sharing, I was a former educator. You know the demands and the expectations of teachers. Then you have to see it from the other side of the desk as an administrator.
Yeah, this job is all about perspective. So having a perspective as a teacher, which I think the foundation for educational leadership is in the classroom, understanding how the classroom works, and good teaching and learning is a foundation for leadership. You can't lead if you don't have that understanding. But then you get into the area of becoming an assistant principal, well, now I got to deal with school-wide discipline. And we know how important it is in having a system of behavior management. We're all are on one family trying to do the right thing. And then you become a principal, and then you end up in division positions. So you look at curriculum. What does that look like across an entire district? What does budgets, what do they look like in an entire division? And so all of those perspectives, I think, lead into the aspect of actually running a district. And when I say running, it's all about teamwork. There isn't any one person. It's bringing a team of folks together that are committed and passionate about supporting good teaching and learning.
How long were you in the classroom?
So I spent 8 years at Heritage High School. I was a world geography teacher.
And again, something we were talking about right before we went on the air today, the ability that you were able to bring from your experiences in the military and also having lived in Romania that you were able to bring into the classroom because of that.
Well, understanding the world and how, you know, around us and how it works in different perspectives, I believe that's all happens in history and social studies classes and understanding history and how economics and population and all of that play. It helps us be better human beings and really relate to one another. So that's what I really enjoyed about that job. And having been, you know, an immigrant, having been a soldier, having been an ESL student, and all of those experiences really provided me with a foundation to relate to my students.
We're taking your calls today. We are with Dr. Anthony Vladu from the Gloucester County Public Schools, 440-2665. And school superintendents, now this position, you have to move the division in the right direction. You have to ultimately ensure that the students are learning, while you also simultaneously have to appease a lot of stakeholders, the teaching staff, the school board, community, the government policymakers, people like city council, of course, the school board, parents. How much of a balancing act really is it?
Is that game where we have the push pins, so you push ones out there? The other ones go up, but it's entirely a balancing act. And I think clarity and leadership is important in protecting the classroom and protecting the work of teachers. And let me just share this. There are two types of employee in Gloucester County Public Schools. There are teachers and everybody else who supports teachers, including me. And we talk about the budget and transportation and maintenance and roofs and heating, HVAC. All of that goes into protecting and supporting the classrooms. So that's really a balancing act, because then you work in the realm of folks that are funding schools, politics, parents, competing issues. But having a strategic plan and having goals and bringing people together on those goals, which are student achievement and student safety, is critically important. That must be the true north.
Do you go into that balancing act and trying to work with the stakeholders, knowing in the back of your mind that really everybody is here to ensure the best interest of the student?
That's the platform. But listening, right? That if you don't listen to people without wanting to respond, you end up where folks are just don't want to participate in the process. So we do a great job in Gloucester in having listening sessions in the community open. Listening sessions with support staff, teachers, athletic advisory panels. So all of these folks are actually coming together. We listen to them and do the best that we can for our students.
In your opinion, has the role of superintendent changed in the past few years? You know, today information moves much, much quicker. The media landscape has changed. And of course, social media makes issues and thoughts move very, very fast through the community. Does the role require more public interaction, PR, selling of ideas than really policy design and educational issues?
So I'm a student of history, and I think every generation thinks things are harder than they used to be, but I think it would probably be very difficult to be a superintendent in the 1970s and 80s and 90s. I'm not sure if it's more difficult, but it is an all-in kind of job, 365, 7 days a week, 24/7, and keeping students safe and listening and engaging the public and in making sure that everybody's on one theme, cohesive theme to support the students.
Let's look at the demographics of the Gloucester School Division. How many students, teachers, how many schools?
So I'm proud to report that we have a total of 800 employees, not including substitute teachers, which are critically important, and other part-time positions like coaches. So these are full-time employees. We employ 399 teachers, and the rest are support staff. And we have some other licensed positions, school psychologists, social workers, speech language, a number of other positions. So 800 in total.
And how many schools are in the division?
So we have in the district, we have 5 elementary schools that feed into 2 middle and feed into 1 comprehensive high school.
Gloucester High School, which recently underwent a massive renovation.
I am so proud of that work, that the community decided to make that a priority and invest in that building. And the facilities are just phenomenal. I have heard from so many students how positive that experience is. Plus, I'm a data person. So we've been looking at student climate through the DCGS survey and other indicators. Students are enjoying come into that building. And I'm just so proud to have come in at the tail end of that construction. Much of that work was done by my predecessors.
I realize that you came in. Did they have to take a lot of things into account into making a modern facility for students? And we're going to talk a little bit about this today, that students learn vastly different than when you and I went to school. Was that taken into account when they were doing this modernization of Gloucester, which is, from my understanding, was a pretty massive undertaking?
It was extensive. So much of the previous construction, since it was done in pockets, there weren't solid walls, floor to ceiling, so you could hear between the classrooms sometimes in some of those older buildings. We also expanded at NJROTC. We have one of the biggest programs where now they have, during inclement weather, they could do formation inside of the building. We also updated some of our CTE programs. A little known fact, Gloucester has some amazing CTE program, career and technical education, workforce programs, automotive, culinary. We have an EMT program, a nursing program, certified nursing assistant, and then a construction program, cybersecurity. So all of that was taken into consideration to make sure that we have a world-class facility that serves the needs of students and staff.
Have other divisions taken a look at it?
I haven't had many folks asking to come visit us, but we're open. If anybody wants to come and see our building, please contact me.
I actually, when I was teaching, we went through a renovation of my building, and we actually went to I was on a team that went and looked at other schools and just, kind of took some ideas into mind. What did we want with this and fed that into the powers that be. We're taking your calls today. It's Education Matters here on 89.5 WHRV. We are going to take a short break and be right back. It's Education Matters on 89.5 WHRV. We are talking with Dr. Anthony Vladu, superintendent of the Gloucester County Public Schools. I'm Barry Graham, and we are taking your calls, 757-440-2665, to offer your comment and your questions. And actually, we have a call from Greg in Norfolk. We'll be going to that call in just a moment. They are actually in the process of getting that call in. So, Dr. Vladu, once again, your recent budget request for the next school year indicated that the division would be down slightly with the number of students. And for the past 5 years, you have noticed that there have been some lower numbers for students coming into the division. Tell me the concerns that raises when you're trying to, one, get as much funding as you possibly can for the division, but by the same token, you're noticing that your numbers are down.
Yeah. No, thank you for sharing that. One of the things that happens is that not only are we an educational agency, we have employees, and those employees have to be compensated, and they have to be compensated competitively. So compensation is a challenge. So in Virginia, we fund schools per pupil. So there's a formula, and when enrollment goes down, we have to make reasonable or responsible reductions. For instance, if you have 150 less students to teach, then that equates to approximately 1.5 million dollars less. Meanwhile, we have to move the ball forward to expand the educational opportunity. So compensation is a challenge, and how do we continue to provide competitive compensation? The other thing is health insurance. Many of our employees are working for health insurance, and health insurance, it's expensive, but it's much needed, and it's a great benefit. So that, again, we have a 15% increase, projected increase for the following year. So folks may think, well, you're losing 150 students, but your budget should stay the same or go down. I would argue it's going to take 3% more next year for us to keep the lights on. We know utilities and power is more expensive. Energy is more expensive. I also provided some information to the school board in my meeting. Parts for school buses, brake shoes, brake pads, those arm motors, the LED lights, all of that's gone up on average at 36% in 1 year. And so it's important that we project an accurate budget, that we make the necessary adjustments to that loss of students, but continue to invest in public education, because we believe in Gloucester, the best place to educate students and to prepare them for the real world is in Gloucester County Public Schools.
Now, last summer, the Department of Education, Federal Department of Education, you were looking at a potential cut in funding from them for some grants.
So it was a lot of uncertainty with the Department of Education. However, the uncertainty did not result in less funding. And so we have continued to receive Title I, Title II, I want to say Title III, some, not as much there, and Title IV, and then 6B. So that funding continues to come in, and I am so glad that that continues, because we rely heavily on that federal funding, particularly for reading recovery, special education, professional development, and other critical things that our teachers and staff need.
So in addition to having to prepare a budget and get that, you also have to deal with the other side of it, with continuing to make the case for needed funding from federal sources, which I imagine in this climate is very difficult.
Absolutely. And we also educate approximately 12% of military-connected students. These are the sons, the daughters of active duty, reserves, of federal employees. And then, again, that takes money to for those transitions, for the education, and all the other things that we need to provide a quality education.
We are going to take a call. We have Greg from Norfolk. Greg, thanks for calling Education Matters.
Thank you so much. Very interested in the remodel you did. And I'm a school bus driver in the Virginia Beach School District, so I always wonder, about the mix of open campus versus the security we need these days with all that's going on in the world. When they did the remodel, does it still have an open campus feel, or how did you incorporate that, and what was your considerations and security measures with the remodel?
Yeah, no, thank you for that, Greg. I want to start by thanking you. School bus drivers are very dear, and especially in my heart. I mean, thinking about teaching is like driving a 20-ton vehicle with 60 kids behind you, and you do that every day. So thank you for doing that for our profession. You can't teach kids if you don't bring them to school. As far as the campus situation works, during the construction, we're one of the only construction projects in Virginia where we had a in-school construction project. In other words, for a period of 3.5 years, major construction was happening at the same time that education was happening, teaching, learning, athletics, a whole bunch of other things. And I got to commend our district. During this time, we experienced the highest growth. And we only missed 2 days during the three and a half, four years that construction happened. So I commend our teachers for being flexible. There are a million reasons why you couldn't do this, but our teachers and our staff and our school security and transportation did a phenomenal job with that. So we did have to think about safety quite a bit. So when I came in, again, I needed eyes on students because they were moving between the trailers and they were moving between the building. And at any given time, one third of the students are going outside, like an open campus feel. So the first thing I reached out to E.T. Gresham, I said, I need a perimeter fence around it. I need to make sure that, you know, folks that are driving on short lane, that they don't see what's happening. So I think a term from the military, I look, cover and concealment is like, well, you shouldn't be seeing these transitions. And two, we need to have eyes on. So we put a actually an outside security shed, and we equip that shed with cameras and with with heating and air conditioning, and made it comfortable, because our motto is eyes on, radios, communications, all of that had to happen. And plus, we had a lot of additional staffing. So I'm grateful to our school board for, you know, making those necessary adjustments. And it was one of the hardest things I think our staff had gone through, but they came out of it and with flying colors that our achievement improved during that time.
You know, it's amazing to think that, you know, in addition to have to ensure that you're undergoing this massive renovation, you have to ensure that the school day is still there for the students and the athletics and the learning. But the other side, you also have to take on this added responsibility of ensuring that the security and the safety of the students and the staff.
Yeah, and I couldn't be more proud, because what a great lesson for our kids. That, you know, your house get remodeled and you don't know where your toothbrush is, and you might not know where that is, you still got to go to work. And I think it was just a great example of how teachers and staff demonstrate and show the kids what is possible if you have a flexible growth mindset.
We have a call from Stephen in Norfolk. Stephen, thanks for calling Education Matters.
Hi. Yeah, I had a question about the thought process and moving from teaching and being in the classroom to being an administrator, and what he thought he could accomplish as an administrator that he couldn't as a teacher.
Thank you for that question, Stephen. So teaching was my favorite job, and it still is. And the reason I say that, in my position, I never had any grand plans to become a district leader, a building leader. But I did have a hunger to have an impact. And so I taught for 8 years, and I was watching the work of assistant principals, and I said, well, I could do that. And now I could impact perhaps several departments. And I did that job for a little bit, and I was watching my principal, said, I could do that. I'll go back to school, get a degree, and I could lead the school. And that's sort of been my pathway. There's never been a grand plan, but everything starts with teaching. But I wanted a life of impact. I wanted to be able to be helpful. And that sort of drove me here. It was totally accidental.
Another fact that I think a lot of people don't realize, that, you know, people who go into administration, they're holding down usually a full-time teaching job and family responsibilities, things like that, but also going to graduate school on the side. It's quite a task to undergo. Dr. Vladu, you actually touched a little bit on this in this talking about the modernization of Gloucester High. Kids today really learn very differently, vastly different than when we were in elementary school or high school even. Technology has replaced common elements like the blackboard, textbooks, worksheets, even smart boards, which I used when I was in the classroom. How does the school system stay abreast of these changes? You know, instead of resisting, schools really have to embrace things like AI. Does the division really look at the trends of where, say, technology is going?
It is, and I think having a philosophy where the human element is not going to be replaced by any technology. Technology is a tool that facilitates learning. So take AI, for instance, and many of us use it. And I have a superintendent advisory groups with students, and I asked our seniors, said, how many of you have heard of AI? And everybody's hands rose. Then I say, well, how many of you use AI? And they look down. And so what that meant to me is that they are using AI, but that pointed the finger back at me and said, well, we need a division policy, and we need a process where students need to be able to know how to use AI. So in my initial budget presentation back in January, I cited the International Monetary Fund study on AI. In developed countries, anywhere between 60 to 70% of jobs currently involve AI. Think about writing a letter late in the day. Generally, you would head that letter, you draft it, now you run it by somebody, an administrative staff, to catch some edits. Well, AI can do that for you right now. AI can also looks at a data set, and right, you know, if you want to look at the descriptive statistic for a data set, standard deviation, so on, you don't have to spend hours. AI can do that for you. But it doesn't replace the thinking, and it doesn't replace the human being. most importantly, is the ethics of AI. When should it be used and when should it not be used? So we start with the ethics in mind to thinking, when is it appropriate? For instance, I think about our English teachers. Worst case scenario that somebody uses AI to turn into paper. And now they're not learning anything. There is no educational value. But what if students could use AI to, after they do the first draft, to give feedback? So tell me what I'm missing. That's a different use of AI. But in the absence of policy and processes, folks are just trying to figure for their own. And our students should not find out about AI if they're getting in trouble on the job for using it, or they're expected to use it because they're not effective enough. So we developed a task force. Our work is going to start in March. We're a little bit behind the power curve on this because AI is already ahead of us. But it all starts with the ethical use of AI.
And as far as technology and the way kids learn, I mean, it's a continuous changing process.
So in my budget, I included additional funding. We're actually not funding. We have 5-year replacement cycles. Those Chromebooks we have during the pandemic, with pandemic ESSER funds. Well, you know, we have to have a replacement cycle. So the Chromebooks have replaced, for the most part, textbook in the classrooms. And so that kids are learning, or students are learning, using that Chromebook assessment, common formative assessment. We think whether we use iXL or a STAR performance assessment. So they have really replaced a lot of that work in the classroom. And so we are ahead of those trends, sometimes catching up with those trends, like with AI. But technology is here to stay. And think about this show, where in your job, whoever is thinking that technology doesn't have a place, look at your job you're doing right now, and there's a tremendous amount of technology. And we have to prepare students for that world.
Well, certainly as we're using it in our jobs, we have to realize, do you really think students are not using this also? Mm-hmm. Of course, they are. Very often, they're ahead of the curve from us in the workplace. Noel from Pocosin, you're on Education Matters. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. My name is Noel Talcott. I'm actually a York Pocosin Master Gardener, and we're currently working with the carpentry students there at Gloucester High School. Previously, we worked with the former instructor there, Tim Eckstein, who transferred from New Horizons in Newport News up to Gloucester High School. So what we're doing with the students is having them build projects for us, using our outdoor gardens, build things for the public. And the benefit of that is it gives the students different projects other than learn how to frame a house. We reimburse the students for the cost of any materials plus an additional 10%, with the goal of that 10% being bankrolled so that at the end of the year, graduating seniors who aren't going to college may benefit from the funds there so that they can go out and take an exam to become an apprentice or something like that. But the program has been really great. The students are currently eligible to participate in a statewide competition called the Lumber Cup, where they'll build projects, and if they're selected, they'll be showcased at the state fair.
Well, Noel, thank you so much for your support. I couldn't say it better myself. That is the nature of education. We think, and I go a little bit outside of that. So we think about the high school diploma having a value in the workplace. It does. But that carpentry certification, that does as well. So we have to start thinking differently about high school. Knowing how to frame, knowing how to interact with the public. And that's an enterprise you describe, where in that program, not only learning about framing, carpentry, making joints, wood joints, all of that, but you also learning how to deal with the public, work with outside organizations, deal a little bit of budgeting, deal a little bit of money. And so what a great example of what education could be. And so that is a strategic goal of ours. Currently, out of the 1,490-some students at the high school, we have 1,100 students that are being touched by one or more career and technical education programs.
Well, the skilled trades have sounded the alarm on the lack of vocational training across the country, saying, you know, some systems had stigmatized vocational education, divisions instead pushing students towards this, you know, college prep versus vocational training. It sounds like the Gloucester schools are really invested in vocational training. You mentioned the modernization of the school, how you had the facility, make sure that they had things like automotive.
Yeah. So I want to share that we look at the senior exit data. Now, how many students are actually going to the workforce? How many are going to a 2-year, 4-year, and the military? Based on that data, we have more than half of the students, if you're looking at Virginia compared to the state, that are going straight to the workforce. Actually, more 200%. Let's, if there's 30%, for instance, that are going from Gloucester to a post-secondary school, at the state level, maybe 60% of the students are going to a post-secondary. What does that mean for me as a superintendent and organization, our community? We need to be able to do a better job with career and technical education. Take, for instance, welding. We talk about all these data centers. It takes a lot of wiring and electricians to make this work. HVAC, everybody's got a heat pump. And these are jobs that are making $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 entry level. So we could prepare students for college, which should lead to a career, or these students can start a career right away. So that's why I'm so proud about Gloucester, that we're not trying to increase the number of students that graduate with an advanced diploma. We're offering dual enrollment, we're offering classes, but we are trying to increase the number of students who have a real world wage earning skill. And yes, you could still be a doctor and know how to frame. And you could still be a lawyer and a fireman or an astronaut that knows how to do culinary. And I think you could do both. And that's really where our focus is. And I love that community because I didn't do anything new. I just get to carry the work that was started before me.
So you are offering a number of these certifications that the students can get, just like some students can get college credit in their advanced placement classes and the vocational educational program. You're offering some of these certifications.
Absolutely. And I have to brag on this a little bit. Our certified nursing assistant course, we produce 40 per year, licensed nurse, certified nursing assistants. And many of those students go on to medical school, but nevertheless, they got their start in the medical profession right there at Gloucester High School with a real industry skill. And they're working jobs throughout the community in the medical field.
Conversely, let's also look at sort of STEM education, which really has replaced in so many divisions and emphasis in schools. Can you cite STEM efforts that have been ongoing in Gloucester?
So, for instance, the elementary school, we have a technology resource class where students will learn how to program robots and, you know, getting them to follow commands and getting to build them. At the middle school level, we have a project Lead the Way with robotics kids and programming. We go to competitions on that, and the high school day students can take cybersecurity and IT. But it's more that needs to be done. I could see expanding to aeronautics, and we know that drones are particularly important right now in the industry and in insurance work and surveying work and construction work and defense and you know military as well as police operations. So that's another skill. So we want to do more, but it goes back to that fundamental thing, funding. And all of these programs I talked about requires the community to invest in students and invest in the future. It's one of those things, pay now or pay later. You could pay now and have a better workforce, or you could pay later through additional services. So I'm just so grateful for anybody that supports this kind of work.
As Education Matters, and we are talking with Dr. Anthony Vladu of the Gloucester County Public Schools. We will be right back. Welcome back to Education Matters. I'm Barry Graham, talking today with Dr. Anthony Vladu, superintendent of the Gloucester County Public Schools. Dr. Vladu was appointed superintendent in 2023. We're taking your calls at 757-440-2665. And Dr. Vladu, school divisions everywhere, including locally, have been struggling to find teachers, especially teachers of color. Some have even had to begin the school year with vacancies and continuous recruitment. Where do you think is the greatest need in teaching? And also, what's really driving these shortages?
Well, I'll start by saying that it is a struggle for us. Our number one priority is to put a highly qualified teacher in front of students. But that's going to look differently because we are struggling as districts. So developing internal pipelines is critically important. Teach for Tomorrow programs, offering students, high school students, internships while they're in high school. Teaching is a profession. And we just finished talking about all this career and technical education, but how many times do we think about we're going to take high school seniors to be interns? So talking about the diversity hiring, we want to make sure that the teaching profession is represented by our vibrant community. Well, we have to reach out to folks and say, are you interested in the teaching internship? I think you're going to make a good teacher. And say that to a ninth grader, a 10th grader, a 12th grader. As a profession, we have to help students realize that this is one of the career choices that they have. So for us, our greatest hiring pool is a substitute pool. So you come in as a sub, you get to learn a little bit about us, and then we could pay for you to go to school and you could become a teacher, take some classes, you could become a teacher for us. It used to be that you go out there to colleges to recruit. That's not a return on investment. We love colleges. Please give them to us. But you go in, there are no special education teachers that are available. And if they are, they probably got jobs already, probably in the second year of college. So it's going to look different. Pipelines, substitutes, pair educators. You start as a teaching assistant. And we're very, very fortunate. We have a vacancy rate of just about 2%. And that's because of hiring from the internally and using different pipelines, including the military. Folks are getting out of the military and they want a profession. We're open for business.
You certainly can attest to that. You could be a great spokesperson for for that aspect from former military. But why do you think people are not seeking careers in education? I look back a number of years ago, and it was difficult to get into systems, difficult to get a position. Now it's the reverse. They are really seeking people. What do you think is driving this?
There are so many folks here in Virginia that actually came from the great teaching colleges in the Northeast. Many of us moved here to teach because over there, you got a job, you stay there until you're 35. Those pipelines have dried up because there are not as many individuals interested in going to education. There was an ACT study a while back about a career inventory. It said very few educators are actually recommending education as a career. And so, one, we have to do a better job in education to recruit for the future. So there, it's a delayed gratification job. If you're looking at compensation, that's often a barrier. If you want to make a lot of money, unfortunately, education is not it. And it should be where we should provide competitive compensation. If you're an individual with a four-year degree, master's degree, and you're a doctorate degree, and you choose to teach, then we should compensate you at least at the national average. So that's a struggle. And also, I think too often, public attacks, and we value input, but educators do at times feel under their attack for one issue or the other with no context provided. And so I think as a society, we could value the work of teachers, still be critical of the profession because we're all invested in it, but we should not diminish the role of educators because the reason we are here today is because of educators. The other thing, I got to do this. Public education is the foundation of our democracy. If you're thinking about our founding fathers, thinking about what does the world look like when you get out there, a good democracy is not where we all operate in clusters. It's when we understand each other's perspective. That's why public education is at the core of a healthy democracy, and we must continue to invest in that.
Oh, absolutely. So well said. Let's look back on the effects of the pandemic. And I have also asked other superintendents and educators this question, but I'm interested in your take. We're now 5 years post-shutdown of the Commonwealth schools. They shut down in the spring of 2020, did not reopen for in-person classroom learning until September 2021. And some studies indicate that years of gains in reading and writing were wiped out. Absenteeism soared. We know that former Governor Youngkin even established a mandate addressing absenteeism in school. And I recently have read that there are some experts that believe that it could take an entire generation of students and also parents to really grasp the idea of students need to be in the classroom. They need to be in school.
Yeah, I'm very respectful that the world changed a lot since the pandemic and all of us were affected. But at some point, we just got to move on, right? And I'll explain what I mean by that. During the pandemic, a lot of learning happened remotely, synchronous or asynchronous. And I don't like using those words on the radio, but you either learn in person in real time or you made up some packets and turned it in for grades. Well, we know that's not the best way to learn for all students. Prior to the pandemic, we did have virtual classes, and we know it's a great way to learn for some students, but not for all students. The pandemic came along, and now all students are learning remotely at least a year to 2 years, depending on the district. Well, there is a learning loss, particularly through you missing that facial interaction. Elementary teachers, I feel for them, because if you're trying to learn how to form words and not being able to read somebody's mouth, that's extremely critical. But 5-6 years in to this, the human potential is too big to be limited by one factor. I came here again, not speaking any English, in seventh grade. And I had to make that thought. I had to graduate from high school, 5-6 years later. And so with that, I don't want to diminish the human potential. The human potential is there, that give us 3-4 solid years with the students, we can make things happen. But having said that, there are a lot of folks that suffered during the pandemic. They didn't receive the educational resources that they needed. But we're here, we're open for business, and we are in the business of closing learning gaps.
Have you seen an increase in attendance in school? Have we pretty much gotten beyond that?
So chronic absenteeism is a struggle, and it gets measured on the new school performance framework, revised framework. And if students are not coming to school, we can't prepare them for the future. So it is lower than before the pandemic. And I think this is a very complicated issue, and we talk about chronic absenteeism for a very long time. But we need to measure, and we are. We need to improve it, and we are. And our students need to feel loved, and they're welcome, and they need to feel engaged when they come to school. So that's the number one thing about improving attendance, making that school experience a place where you want to be. But also, it's the law. You're required, unless you're homeschooling, you're required to come to school, because an educated public makes for a better society. And so is the law. But when you are there, we're going to maximize your time. We have made quite a few gains. The goal is 15% or less. But think about us adults. 10% of the school year is 18 days. If you miss 18 days, you're chronically absent. So at times, particularly students that are dealing with medical situations, but they're still included in that in some cases. I think we can do a little better in having some flexibility with that chronic absenteeism, because we ourselves take FMLA, we ourselves get sick, and so that also applies to children. And we need a little more flexibility from the state when it comes to how to define chronic absenteeism.
Have you made that case to state educators, to state authorities around the issue?
So we have spoken about this, and we have a regional superintendent's meeting. We also meet with VASS, and this is no secret. Short of having to write them a letter or engage in a letter campaign, I think our leaders are aware of how we feel about this.
Let's talk about recent SOL scores. Congratulations, yeah. Every school in your district fully accredited. Any initiatives that the division enacted to see those type of results?
Absolutely. It starts with teamwork. So, the district has done well previously, but in the past 3 years, we had record graduation rates. We were ranked 38th in the state out of 131. In 2023, we're ranked 15th in this year. We also had a blue ribbon recognition. And by the way, I want to thank the Virginia Department of Education and the State Board of Education for recognizing blue ribbon awards, because it is the top certifications, top award that a school can earn. And so, but that happened through focusing on the fundamentals. What are the fundamentals? Curriculum alignment. If we're going to teach a lesson, I'll take government. About the three branches of government, it's so much better if you learn from current events and you talk about it versus from a textbook. Or talk to your legislator or bring speakers in. So the way you teach makes a huge difference. Talking about mathematics, let's talk about building thinking classrooms. How do we do math? Math is a language for explaining the real world. And so the curriculum alignment, looking specifically at the verbs, the nouns, and the application of those things in the real world, that's how progress is made. And our number one, I think, reason why we've done that is through the work of teachers. I don't teach classes. Neither does anybody on my team. But I believe our teachers feel supported. And so looking at the PLC process, professional learning communities, where teams of teachers are using a 2-week common formative assessment, where you give a short assessment, you point the finger back at practice, hold the students accountable, but there are gaps. I, as a teacher, have to be humble enough to understand that the way I explain things may not be the best way to explain it. So keeping the dialogue open is extremely important, but also focusing on working conditions. You have to feel good about coming to work. So what do our principals and our building leaders do in order to keep school culture at the top? Because if you don't feel good about coming to work, you're less likely to do a good job. Having folks that feel listened to, it's a whole system, but the curriculum is key in accessing that learning.
Is it very difficult? And I, as a former classroom teacher, I can attest that, that it is. You have to keep in mind what you said, engaging the students in for example, government and in real world politics, but also to not teach to the test. That is a difficult thing for teachers to navigate.
Oh, absolutely. And so easy to go down that road versus compliance versus the joy of teaching. We have to keep the joy of teaching and the passion. That's what we got into this profession. So with that, the Virginia Department of Education does do a good job with putting out a high quality curriculum. In a perfect world, we should never worry about the test. If we teach the standard, the SOLs are not just a test. They're standards that go along all year long. And they're Algebra 1 standards. PE has standards. By the way, music has SOLs too. They just don't have to test it yet.
Right.
But looking at those curriculum objectives and teaching them in an authentic and engaging kind of way. And no, I don't want, in a perfect world, testing would be the last thing we focus on. I had this conversation with principal this morning. If we focus on process, we don't have to worry about results. What does that look like? Student engagement, bell to bell, curriculum alignment, positive relationships, parent engagement, and not taking no for an answer. When a student is not learning, let's call an IEP team meeting and see how can we get this whole group of educators around this one student and do wraparound support services. So if the process is tight, I don't think you have to worry about scores.
Last fall, the State Board of Education raised the cut scores for passing the SOLs, and some educators said it could result in a greater numbers of failing, and also, as a better way to put it, some said, hey, wait a minute, you're sort of changing the rules in the middle of the game here. What was the result there?
Now, thank you for bringing that up, because talk about life-changing. So in Virginia, the standards of learning is sort of, you know, come in, there's a curriculum, there's an accountability, and then that's just been the case for since I got to Virginia back in 2000. So I'm a math person, I'm a proportion person, and I want to give you some real facts about Gloucester, because I was one of the individuals who raised the alarm bells about the cut scores. If you just look at the data set and you look at our students with disabilities, we had a graduation rate of 97.7%, and that's a lot of work. So their students with disabilities are graduating at rates because they're just as high as anybody else. If you raise the SOLs cost cut scores to a 450 when I did the analysis for our district, that would ensure about all but two of the last graduating class would have graduated. So what other rule are we implementing where it affects an entire group of people? And so then there's the gradual increase in that. So the what will happen, what may happen is as these rates or this cut scores are rates, it get to a point where all our students and all our teachers are doing is narrowly focusing on standards in order to do well on a test versus do some of the stuff that we talked about. I would prefer that we invest in career and technical education. I would prefer that we have, you know, minimum competency tests, because you do have to earn a high school diploma. But do you have to earn it at, you know, pass to have an 85% on an SOL versus a minimum passing rate? Because I might not write for a living. I might well for a living.
Right.
So I think our folks are with this. We'll support whatever. I'm a state employee, but I have to advocate for students and I have to advocate for staff. And I would think that we need to proceed into these with data, with information, with training, and look at the impact they will have on our communities.
Final question for you today. Let's fast forward, and you're retired, and you are invited to teach a course to aspiring superintendents. Can you give me maybe two to three key points that you would convey to the students in the class who are aspiring to become superintendents? What would you tell them?
Well, why do you want to do this job? Because that why has to be strong. And think, you know, this is the kind of job where you are up at 3 a.m. thinking, how am I going to deal with the budget gap or a budget situation or an employee matter or a community member who is on social media just portraying a very, very narrow and negative part of school. So if that why is strong, please go ahead. I will just say this is a very rewarding job. But it has to be about students, and it has to be about bringing a community together and listening and not marginalizing people. If that's not it, then perhaps there are other jobs that you could be more happy in.
Our thanks today to Dr. Anthony Vladu, superintendent of the Gloucester County Public Schools. You can find out more information about the Gloucester County Public Schools at gets.gc.k12.va.us. Gloucester County Public Schools are stakeholders in Heretta, which holds the license for the WHRO station. All calls to the program are screened for appropriate content. I'm Barry Graham, host and producer for the program. Our audio engineer is Jordan Christie. Neil Johnson answered our phones. Our theme music is an original composition by Todd Washburn. Special thanks to WHRO CEO Bert Schmidt, WHRO Chief Content Officer Heather Mazzoni, Senior Director Audio Content and Audience Strategy Chuck Dowd. This and previous Education Matter programs can be found on demand at whro.org. Thank you for joining us. It's Education Matters.